A wonderful, a wonderful. And now on with the show.
Well, I don't know where that one came from. What was that? That was a wonderful, a wonderful, a one and a two. What's his name? The champagne guy? What? Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and thank you for joining me today. 2 hours ahead of us of Clear Thinking Christianity, coast to coast. Actually, around the globe on the World Wide Web. But really, live Southern California in Portland. Glad you've all joined me, and I look forward to talking with you, especially our second hour, on anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Lawrence Welk is the name. Yeah, I had a senior moment there about that senior guy who's long gone now, but that's the wonderful guy, Lawrence Welk. Well, we don't have Lawrence Welk on today. We have me and also a guest that I'll be introducing in just a moment. His book is actually called Moral Darwinism. Before I get to our guest, just to give you the numbers in case you want to get in the queue for our second hour. Now, we won't be taking calls for an hour. We usually take calls both hours unless I have a guest, and then I generally keep them to myself, as I'll be doing today. But our number for the record, 1-800-227-5278, and the 714 area code in Southern California, that's where I am locally. The number is 754-4150. If you're listening on the World Wide Web, you can call in during show times, 3 to 5 Sunday afternoons. That would be Los Angeles time, and the 800 number will suffice you, unless you're out of the country, and then you have to dial the 714 number, 714-754-4150, and pay the toll, but we'll put you at the head of the class. The book is Moral Darwinism. A title like that always attracts my attention because I'm interested in the issue of Darwinism, as you all know, and the issue of morality, as you all know. I'm published in the area. And I think the two are connected in a kind of an odd way, and that's somewhat what we're going to be talking about today, and not just Darwinism per se, but a philosophical foundation that leads up to Darwinism and makes a home for Darwinism, so to speak, materialism. The author, Benjamin Weicker, he's a member of the Discovery Institute, our friends up there in Seattle, Washington, who have been making a great contribution to the issue of intelligent design. Professor Weicker has received his PhD, let's see, he's a lecturer in theology and science in the Franciscan University there at Steubenville in Steubenville, Ohio, and his PhD from theological ethics from Vanderbilt University. Dr. Weicker, I got all of that stuff out of the way, and now it's time for the fun stuff. You and I, welcome to the show.
I'm very glad to be here.
You know, before I get into the details of your fine book, which had me captivated as I moved through the material, this looks like a book you had a fun time writing. Is that right?
Well, in some respects, I never thought of it quite that way, but in some respects, I guess it was, seeing all the connections that I had thought about for so many years,
right,
finally getting them down concretely, but it took a lot of coffee and a lot of...
Sure. Well, all writing does. And for me, you know, it takes a team of horses to get me sitting down and typing. And to me, writing is like jogging. You know, I hate to get started. I hate to keep going. But when I'm done, I'm glad I did it.
Yeah.
You know, then you can enjoy the benefits. But I think it is what you pointed out. There is a coherence to this whole account, which really is an historical account that doesn't begin with Darwinism per se, but ends with Darwinism. And it's a fascinating account, especially given my interest in philosophy and the history of philosophy and how ideas have consequences. And this is really at the heart of your book. So let me see if I can start out this way. As I was going through your book, I found what might be considered the thesis of your book on page 215, though I think you've stated it in other places in different words.
Alrighty.
And what that quote says is, the origin of species, which is Darwin's piece, was the result of the permeation of Western intellectual culture by the materialistic tenets of Epicureanism. So now you've kind of linked a 19th century idea that's built into the 20th and the 21st century, arguably the most profound idea in terms of its impact, of late with a 4th century BC concept. And so there's a sense in which, though Darwinism is a scientific idea in people's mind, it didn't arise in a philosophical vacuum, but has a philosophical pedigree. And is that a fair way of capturing the overall tone of your book and intent of it?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, that is the most surprising thing, perhaps, for people while they read the book is to discover that Darwinism is not new. That is, we're taught everywhere that this was just one of the most magnificent, groundbreaking discoveries in the middle of the 19th century, and it's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a
19th century discovery, is that what you mean?
No, it isn't. It is not a 19th century discovery at all. It's actually a logical inference from a materialistic worldview, and as you rightly point out, that view goes all the way back 4 centuries before Christ.
Well, since this is really the theme of your book, that it's kind of a philosophical history on a certain strain of thought that goes back to the 4th century, why don't we just start there and tell us a little bit about Epicurus and Epicureanism, which I think most people loosely associate with eat, drink, and be merry kind of thing, and tell us how this really became the philosophical forefather of our modern scientific paradigm.
Well, it's a long story, but we can kind of crunch it down a little.
Sure.
Epicurus dies, I think, in 271 BC, and his life was dedicated to establishing a framework of this worldly ease, this worldly tranquility.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that the problem with our lives as human beings was that we were bothered by other worldly concerns.
Mm-hmm.
That is, right at the heart of Epicurus is what I call a therapeutic goal.
Mm-hmm.
How can we bring a tranquil existence, a peaceful existence, to this life? Now, it's his answer to this, which is so interesting. He thought that the way to do it was obviously related to what he considered to be the greatest disturbances bothering human beings. And for him,
mm-hmm.
that was all the things associated with religion and the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
He thought the main problems bothering human beings and causing them all kinds of aggravation, everything from wars to ulcers, was the constant worry about what the gods thought. You know, were the gods trying to get me with lightning? Was this disease a sign of the gods' displeasure? And so on and so on and so on. And so he thought that the way to get rid of this anxiety, it would be to create a universe in which the gods couldn't have any effect,
mm-hmm.
and we human beings wouldn't have to worry about the gods' actions against us.
And that worry was not just what they're going to do now or what they're thinking now, but what's going to happen to us after we die.
Exactly.
So it kind of holds...
Get rid of hell and heaven.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. He doesn't want us, you know, running around worrying about the afterlife. It's bad enough in this time.
Mm-hmm. Now, he doesn't just dismiss gods summarily, in a sense. He attempts to reason to a worldview in which God's existence are not only superfluous, but they don't even really fit in the way we think of them or they thought of them at the time.
Exactly. In other words, you would think, given his worldview, which I call Epicurean materialism, it's a purely materialistic worldview,
mm-hmm.
that there wouldn't be any gods because we associate pure materialism with atheism. But he did something, in a way, I think even more ingenious. He didn't deny that the gods existed. He said that they were actually part of nature.
Hmm.
And furthermore, that the gods do not have any concern for us at all. Their goal is to be tranquil. Their goal is not to be disturbed by us or anyone else.
Hmm.
So his gods sat up in I don't know what, material bliss off somewhere else, and they didn't care anything about human beings.
Mm-hmm. Which was somewhat the goal that he had in mind, too, to find, in a materialistic universe, to become like those material gods who attained this blissful state of detachment. It sounds almost like Buddhism to me. It was the first time I thought about that.
It does have that sound, except that it's got, attached to it, a thoroughgoing scientific materialism. That's mm-hmm. what makes it so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he didn't just make a vague philosophy. He wanted a very determinate natural order to the universe that didn't allow interference by the gods, didn't allow an immaterial soul for human beings. And so he co-opted, took over the materialist atomism of another philosopher named Democritus, and designed it to fit his goals.
Okay, tell us a little bit about atomism. This might be a new term to most to many people.
It's very simple, and in fact, that was the point of his making it. It was very simple. It's the universe has two things in it. One of them are these things called atoms. And these atoms are themselves indestructible. They're eternal. They always have been. They always will be. And they are therefore uncreated. That is, remember, the gods themselves, for Epicurus, are part of nature. And so they, too, are a creation of these atoms. And just like many modern cosmologies, everything in the universe comes about from the jostling of these atoms in the void.
Mm-hmm.
And the void, that is the space between the atoms, is the other constituent of the universe.
So there's stuff, and the stuff where the stuff and the place where the stuff resides, basically, are the two things of the universe.
Yes.
So he doesn't distinguish like the atoms from the energy, as more modern, you know, it's not time, it's not space and energy and matter. Actually, even in the modern sense, there is this kind of metaphysical correlation between energy and matter anyway. So it's still very modern in a certain sense, I guess, and that's part of your point.
Indeed. In fact, it was almost indistinguishable from physics from, say, the 1500s to the end of the 19th century.
And by the way, just for clarification, when he says atoms, he doesn't have the kind of robust understanding of atomic matter that we have now, but he's just identifying that there is an irreducible something that all the matter can be broken down to,
yes.
And that's that kind of final ground of matter stuff that everything else is made up of.
Exactly, he wanted it to have the same effect that modern materialism has. Mm-hmm. That is, you look at the big, beautiful universe, you look at wonderfully complex things, and you think, oh, there must be a god behind this.
Mm-hmm.
Epicurus says, no, it is the random banging together of the atoms over infinite time that created everything you see.
So he simplified things actually a couple ways. He simplified them by just breaking things down into the atomistic level, as it were, into atoms, the smallest, and then he simplified in time and space by making both infinite, you point out in your book, and this also made this view more appealing to people.
Yes. I mean, it seems, gosh, if you have infinite time and infinite space with infinite atoms, then just by random banging around, all the stuff that we see could have been made, could have occurred, and the effect, again, he was after was the effect of relief, of tranquility. Oh, we don't have to worry. There are no gods behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I die, I'm just made up of those atoms, and my body will dissipate, and I will be no more. I have mm-hmm. no heaven to worry about or hell to fear.
Now, I was surprised, because I haven't studied much about Epicurus yet, to learn, contrary to my preconceived notion, is that Epicurus was not Epicurean in the sense that we often think of Epicureans now, fond of luxury and sensuous pleasure, but he was actually an ascetic.
Exactly.
That is, he avoided all of those things as further disturbances. And that certainly isn't the way we're applying it now, is it?
Well, no, but we shouldn't be thrown off too far by that, because what he is really doing in his universe, and this should sound very modern too, should sound like modern utilitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
He's equating the good with bodily pleasure and evil with bodily pain. And that's as high as it gets.
Yeah.
And so your moral goal is you want to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. And for Epicurus, he doesn't do it quite the way, as you say, we would think.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't go out and go to parties all night. In fact, he says if you do that, you only bring on more pain, because you'll get a hangover, and
mm-hmm.
you get beaten up, and furthermore, you have to go out and earn all that money so you can be, you know, a socialite. He said,
mm-hmm.
the best thing to do is withdrawal from society, get used to eating very plain foods, and try to remove all the sources of disturbance that you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was the source of his asceticism. It wasn't a high goal. It wasn't a spiritual goal.
Yeah.
It's actually a very material goal.
It was an egoistic goal, ultimately.
Yes.
Yeah, self-centered goal. Now he had an interesting spin on science here, and all of this is really foundational for what's to come centuries down the line with Darwin, is his spin on science wasn't as I understood your writing, that science was built into this whole enterprise for him, but science wasn't really the search for truth about the world. Science was an attempt to gain this equanimity that he was looking for, that he felt was only possible by coming to a realization of the materialistic nature of the universe. So you get all the threats of gods out of your system, as it were.
Yes, exactly. And he says it. You don't even have to infer it from his writings. He says it right out. If we could be undisturbed, if we could be tranquil without having to have natural science, then that would be just fine.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason we have natural science is that it contributes to our tranquility by giving us what appear to be scientific reasons why you don't have to worry about the gods, and why you don't have to worry about an afterlife.
You know what's very interesting about this, though, I mean, and very timely in a way, in another sense, is that basically you're saying that for Epicurus, science is pressed into service for this other end, which is philosophical/religious. It has to do with the gods and our autonomy from the gods.
Yes.
And I think of the quote, the statement by Richard Lewontin from Harvard that was made in the U.S. Review of Books about 4 or 5 years ago. You might be familiar with this, in which he basically states that that they have constructed an apparatus called science, which is designed to produce materialistic solutions to things or materialistic results, even when they're counterintuitive to reality, because, as he puts it, and I'm quoting here, we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. It just sounds like a restatement of what Epicurus was stating 300 years before Christ.
And Epicurus has an interesting way of putting it. He says, I don't care how you explain how you get lightning. Mm-hmm. Just keep the myths out of it.
Keep God out of it.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter what explanation you give, as long as it sticks to the material basis.
Right. And by the way, what's interesting about that, we're going to have to go to break in just a second, Doctor, but what's interesting about that is, if I can paraphrase that, don't confuse me with the facts. It doesn't matter the way things actually are. We have to come up with an answer about lightning or whatever that comports with this materialistic view of the world. And even if gods were directly responsible, which we now know they weren't, but even if they were, we can't consider that an option. Would that be a fair way of characterizing his view?
I think it's exactly it. In other words, whatever you do, keep your intellect focused on these very simple materialist principles, and don't let it stray, because as soon as it strays, it might go toward belief in the gods.
Right. And I almost was going to say that means Epicurus is thoroughly modern, but see, now there the tail is wagging the dog, isn't it?
Exactly. It's better off to say that
the modern,
you're thoroughly Epicurean.
That's right. My guest here, Benjamin Weicker, he's a member of the Discovery Institute, PhD, in theological ethics from Vanderbilt University. He's written a wonderful book called Moral Darwinism. If you like the history of philosophy at all and you're interested in these issues, which I am, of course, you will find this a delightful education, a romp through history from Epicurus up to the present day, with a whole bunch of Lucretius and Hobbes and Bacon and a whole bunch of those guys all thrown in the mix, as we see how we got from there to here by a very well-defined step-by-step process. And we'll be back with my guest, Benjamin Weicker, in just a moment. Again, the book is Moral Darwinism. I'm Greg Kokel. The show is Stand to Reason.
Hi, friends. This is Scott Klusendorf. And every year in the United States, there are over 1.4 million abortions performed. If you're ready to defend the unborn, then I want to enroll you in a class taught by Greg Kokel and me. Stand to Reason's interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, will prepare you to enter any pro-life arena, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with full confidence that your case is solid and your appeal is just. From the comfort of your own home or church, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned plug-and-play course gives you everything you need to train yourself or a group in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through videotapes, workbooks, role-playing, quizzes, and games, Making Abortion Unthinkable will give you the tools you need to, one, restore meaning to the word abortion through the use of graphic visual aids, two, it will help you simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, thirdly, it's going to give you the scientific evidence you need to make a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, and finally, you're going to be able to expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric. If you're ready to take a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 800-2-AND-THE-WORD-REASON. That's 800-2-AND-THE-WORD-REASON, or visit us online at str.org.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel. Friends, you can help keep Stand to Reason broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift of any size helps us to continue training you and other Christians to be effective ambassadors for Christ in three vital areas. First, knowledge, helping you deliver a message that's accurately informed, made relevant to the culture of the 21st century. Second, wisdom, helping you develop a method that's skillful, tactical, and fair. And third, character, helping you cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about in the church and in the world, please consider supporting STR Radio today. We rely solely on the gifts of friends like you to stay on the air. So please call us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason, or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90807. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90807. And thank you for sending your gift today.
It takes a lot of faith to say we're accidents of nature.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. And before I get back to our guest, I just want to let you know about an event coming up on Thursday evening, October 3rd. I'm giving you advance notice so you can put it on your calendar. I am going to be at this event, not as a player, but as a spectator, like most of you, obviously, because this is worth spectating, okay? As you know, Biola University has a program of distinguished lecturers every fall, spring, and summer. And they have this kickoff event in which they put some pretty sharp people on the stage, and the rest, everybody gets to go for free. You know, it's the first one's free, and the rest you have to pay for. Well, that's the way this works. And so even if you don't go to the subsequent series, which is a fine series, and a series that I've participated in as a lecturer for the last 6 or 7 years, it seems like forever, but as long as the program's been on, I've been involved with that. But this particular event is the freebie, and basically on stage at one time at this event is J.P. Moreland, Hugh Hewitt, Dr. Craig Hazen, John Mark Reynolds, Scott Ray, Eric Thienes, and Dave Horner. I mean, any one of these guys is worth hearing all by themselves. You got the whole group of them on the stage. The series title is The Certainty of Christianity in an Age of Unbelief. This is Thursday evening, October 3rd. It's not at Biola, where it usually is. Let me tell you where it's at. It's at First EV Free in Fullerton. First EV Free in Fullerton. All right? That's on 2801 North Brea Boulevard in Fullerton, California. So just mark your calendar, October 3rd. It starts at 7 in the evening. This is one event you're going to want to get to early to get good seats. It's going to be a lot of fun. We'll be there, and I hope you are as well. So put it on your calendar. My guest today for this hour, for the book Moral Darwinism, is Benjamin Weicker, and he's the author of this fine book, a member of Discovery Institute. And you guys are doing great work out there at the Discovery Institute. I just am thrilled with the contribution you guys are making.
Well, we appreciate that. It's wonderful to be a part of it.
Yeah, good thinkers and good men. And many of them have written, of your colleagues have written endorsements of your book, which turns out to be not really a scientific analysis, which much of the Discovery Institute is given to, kind of a scientific analysis of Darwinism, but really more of a philosophical analysis. Instead of looking at the scientific inadequacy of Darwinism, you focus on the philosophical history that kind of allowed a place for Darwinism to take its root. I mean, in the way that we understand it now, even though, as you pointed out, some of these ideas go back to 3rd century, 4th century BC and Epicurus, certainly the materialism as a view of the universe. Everything's broken down into atoms and the space in which atoms reside. The next person kind of on our hit list here historically is Lucretius, who took Epicureanism to another level and then placed this in direct, in a sense, historically contrast to the tenets of historical Christianity. Tell us about that.
Exactly. It's Lucretius, I've titled it the chapter in the book on Lucretius the first Darwinian, although it should be backwards. Or that's backwards, it should be that Darwin is actually Lucretian.
Mm-hmm.
But it captures that feeling which you get when you read Lucretius and all of a sudden you find all these modern ideas spilling out, including an extended passage on evolution.
Mm.
I mean, it is not, you don't have to ferret it out. It doesn't take great scientific abilities or literary abilities. It's so
right
obvious
there.
That
mm-hmm.
when people read it, they're shocked. They say, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, that's Darwin.
Is this a dissent with modification, generally speaking?
Yeah.
Is that what he's offered?
Yeah, he has. And the only thing that he doesn't talk about, he doesn't use the term natural selection,
mm-hmm.
but he uses all of the intellectual apparatus that gets you there. You have random variations going on in individuals on the atomic level, the ones that have things that contribute to survival
mm-hmm.
survive, and if they can breed, they pass on their traits to the next generation. It's all right there.
Mm. So do you think that Darwin, and I know you speak to this, but I'm just kind of asking for the sake of the listeners, that Darwin was a student of Epicurus or Lucretius? Or
well,
do you think he kind of stumbled upon these ideas on his own? What do you think?
Well, here's how I would put it.
Mm-hmm.
You would not have had to read either of the two directly, because by the time he comes around, their works had been circulating in the West since the 1400s.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucretius, especially, was a hot literary item for hundreds of years, and you know, he was one of the most important and oft quoted sources in the Enlightenment
mm-hmm.
in the century prior to Darwin.
It's kind of like most people won't know who Rorty or Derrida are, but they still are advocates of what turn out to be a postmodern view of the world.
Yeah, so you know, even if Darwin himself had never read these sources. And I have no indication that he ever did.
Mm-hmm.
It permeated the West and actually formed the foundation, this scientific foundation, or I should say the intellectual foundation of the modern scientific materialist revolution
mm-hmm.
that culminates in the stretch from Galileo to Newton.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it's not even accidental. It's essential to understanding the modern the rise of modern scientific materialism,
mm-hmm.
that in great part, if not fully, I'll back off, but I'd say in great part, it was caused by the rediscovery of the ancient texts of Democritus
mm-hmm.
and Lucretius, which occurred in the 1400s and which were published in the late 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, and ignited the fires of those who would embrace materialism and put Epicurean atomism as the foundation of what they considered to be the new science,
mm-hmm.
place Aristotelianism.
Now, one of the things that is really important in this whole discussion, and I think is missed by a lot of people who haven't trafficked in this, especially the philosophical side, is the assertion here that you're defending in your book that something like Darwinism is not just fixed as a scientific concept that is driven merely by a certain type of epistemology or methodology, but is really rooted necessarily in a prior view of what the world is actually like that then determines the kinds of conclusions they can come to. Is that a fair way of putting it?
That's a beautiful way to put it. In other words, I know I repeat myself in the book, but it's sometimes hard for people to realize that it really could be this way, that no one of these people, Epicurus, Lucretius, or even Galileo, or Newton, or Descartes, or any of the other atomists, had ever seen an atom. They had no proof that these eternal dots of matter existed, other than the belief that this was the best way to explain the world. And in modernity, when they take over the Epicurean materialist framework and buy into the notion that these atoms exist, that then determines what they think science is, what exists and what doesn't, what's a legitimate scientific research project, what the universe is like, and so on and so on and so on.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, even though now we have the technology to see the atom essentially, or even smaller parts, and we know the atom isn't the true atom from Epicurus' sense, or the how do you say his name?
Democritus'
sense, because atom means the smallest indivisible unit, and it turns out that there are units even smaller than the atom, we've learned. And that seems to justify the overall picture. It doesn't say anything about the legitimacy of the philosophy of materialism behind those discoveries. I mean, it might be that the atom or some smaller particle is indivisible, but that doesn't follow from that the universe is eternal and that infinite and that the material realm is all that exists, which is part of the presupposition of this whole enterprise.
Exactly. In other words, and this is one of the common complaints of the intelligent design movement, is, wait a second, you're inferring way too much from a very small assumption. And before you leap from one to the other, you really have to have evidence. And what Epicurus allowed a kind of materialist blinder to infuse itself into the modern scientific project, so that even when they did find things that contradicted Epicurean materialism, we still end up being materialists. We don't even understand that it's our own science, oddly enough, has undermined the kind of materialism that has had such a hold on us for so many centuries.
This reminds me of Phil Johnson's observation that there are actually two definitions of science at work in our modern enterprise. One is a methodological definition, and the other one's a philosophic definition. The subject of your book, actually, the philosophic definition, and when the evidence of the methodology contradicts what the philosophy demands, the philosophy wins out every time.
It's very strange. And just to give one example, which you touched upon, it was essential to Epicurus's argument, that is, to his ability to get rid of the gods, that the atom was eternal. And he demanded that as a theoretical beginning point. But at the end of the 19th century, they found out that the atom is not eternal. Well, if the atom is not eternal, then the universe is not eternal. If the universe is not eternal,
nor infinite,
or infinite, but especially, you know, that is, it itself isn't always around. It must have had a cause,
right?
And that cause can't be atoms. Those are the very things that aren't eternal. And that just gets you back to an intelligent designer, and that is when the fear flags roll up,
right? And
now we've
kind of broken the bubble of the equanimity that Epicurus was trying to establish, and we're back into those awful gods looking down at us now and threatening damnation, etc., if we don't live right. And of course, people don't want that. And so, but it does create a, I mean, this is a tremendous, it's an interesting kind of thing from one perspective, Doctor, because on the one hand, the Epicurean view of materialism was allowed to exist for a long time because they presumed the infinite universe, and they had the infinite universe cosmologies and stuff, even Kant. And then since then, we've got an upset from science itself that the universe had a beginning and the boundary conditions of the universe are known time-wise and size-wise. And boy, this throws a big wrench into the whole works.
It does, and it is no accident that when these things started to be discovered, especially around the mid-20th century with mm-hmm. Big Bang cosmology, the materialist scientists were horrified that at Big Bang cosmology for that very reason. They did not want it to be true.
And they resisted it, even Einstein.
They resisted it. Mm-hmm. And they resisted, and they continue to resist, the obvious conclusion that the universe is contingent.
Mm-hmm.
It had a beginning. It isn't self-subsistent.
Mm-hmm.
And they are creating, even now as we speak, absurd theories like the oscillating universe or multiple universes to get around that contingency that science itself discovered.
I like to put it this way, Doctor. If there is a Big Bang, and it seems to me that there is, then there has to be a Big Banger, you know?
Well, you would think.
Uh-huh.
You would think. But I think that you can see the heart of Epicurus still beating when scientists won't just accept that and come up with a far more unlikely theory just to mm-hmm. keep that universe God-proof.
But, it's interesting. You wonder if, given this evidence, if Epicurus would still have held his position, because you cite him as saying, in the Latin, nihilo ex nihilo, in other words, by means of nothing, out of nothing. And so he understood that you don't get something out of nothing, and that's what required his infinite universe cosmology. And now if he knew differently, what would he do, I wonder?
I think he'd squirm. I think that he would do exactly as many cosmologists would do today, and he would sort of retrofit the cosmology
yes.
to get around it in some way, no matter how bad.
And bend the facts.
No matter how bad, because you know that occurs with what the so-called just-so stories in Darwinism,
yes.
when there is no evidence for some kind of complex organ.
Mm-hmm.
To have arisen, yet they will tell the most outlandish tale
mm-hmm.
So to sort of satisfy the gap.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know, but I'll just tell the tale. At least it'll keep us from the possibility that there was an intelligent cause.
Let's save the paradigm at all costs.
At all costs.
No matter how counterintuitive or, as I'm thinking of the words from the quote that I made earlier. From,
yes.
Yeah, no matter how counterintuitive or odd to the uninitiated, you know, it
yes.
may turn out to be. So
exactly.
The Richard Lewontin quote. When we return, I want to talk just a little bit about how this translates itself into the culture wars that we see now and your very bold statement that it is not possible, given what you discovered, to marry descent with modification, Darwinian evolution, materialism, with any kind of Christian understanding of the nature of the universe. So I guess it would be an oxymoron to say that God used evolution. And we'll explore that. When I return, my guest, Dr. Benjamin Weicker of the Discovery Institute, his book, Moral Darwinism, InterVarsity Press is the publisher. It's a great read. I hope you get it. I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason.
Have you ever wished you could articulate your faith and beliefs more clearly? Do you feel confident when talking with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated of subjects like evolution, cloning, and stem cell research. Now you can avoid feeling uneasy or embarrassed when you want to stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today. Don't get caught by surprise. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive manner. Contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. 2 Reason, or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Just request our newsletter called Solid Ground. We'll send it to you free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Did you know that the old car, truck, boat, or RV that is gathering dust in your garage can actually change the lives of Christians around the world? By donating your used vehicle to Stand to Reason, you can help develop training materials that will build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. Don't worry if it won't start. We'll tow it away at no charge and help you with all the paperwork. And when we leave, you'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car. Transform your old vehicle into practical training for Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
You want the truth? You can't handle the truth.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. If you're listening, that's the way what I meant to say, at oneplace.com, I encourage you to scroll down the STR page where you found our show, and you'll see a little title or free offer, Solid Ground. Click that button that says order and follow the prompts. What we'll do is we're going to send you free training material every month, and this includes our newsletter, Solid Ground. You're not going to find in a newsletter pictures of our staff at bake sales. This is not the kind of newsletter it is. It contains every month or every other month, whenever it's published, a hard-hitting, straightforward article that will help you to be a better ambassador for Christ. You'll also receive personal communications from me. That is a letter that I write directly to you. It's more pastoral in tone, but it's still to help you to be a better ambassador. And while you're filling that out, you'll be on our website then. Cruise the website a little bit and check it out, because there are hundreds and hundreds of things there that will help you as a Christian. And some people, we consistently get emails back and people say, gee, I heard about your website, but I didn't realize it was this good. There was this much stuff, and especially things that were very, very helpful. So please go there, str.org. You can find our radio shows up to a year back. You can find our products. You can find hundreds of commentaries and written pieces and outlines and study aids and self-study programs, all geared to strengthen you in the area of knowledge, wisdom, and character as a good ambassador for Christ. So please sign up for Solid Ground if you haven't done so already, and make use of the resource, our website. 700,000 hits last month, 70,000 visitors, and tens of thousands of pieces downloaded, and people do that regularly because they find good stuff there. My guest this hour, Benjamin Weicker, he's the author of Moral Darwinism. How We Became Hedonists is the subtitle, and we're going to talk more specifically now about Darwinism and the moral element here in hedonism, as we've been tracking, Doctor, the development of a philosophical point of view back from the 3rd century up until Darwin's time. You have a statement here that I think helps us to see, in a sense, the significance here of this issue, and it's on page 89 in your book, and you say, inevitably, a society that contains a significant number of materialists, that is a person who doesn't believe in anything but that which is material, and Christians, so when you have these two groups of people, they will be locked in bitter and irreconcilable moral controversy in regard to sexuality and marriage and, frankly, a whole bunch of other things. This is the culture war, isn't it? Doctor, we got in there? Oh, I'm sorry. You're up now.
Yeah, well, it's true, and it's not maybe that pleasant because a lot of people want to find an easy solution to the kinds of conflicts that are causing so much problem now. Can we get some kind of a compromise in regard to abortion, euthanasia, homosexuality, marriage, so on and so on and so on? And one of the reasons that I wrote the book the way that I did was to show that that's impossible.
Because there are fundamentally different views of the world that each side has.
Yeah, they're
incommensurable.
They're not even just different, they're just antagonistic.
Right.
And that is not a new development. If you want to read, you know, the origin of today's culture wars, 2,000 years ago, when Christianity was born into the Roman Empire, and the Epicureans were all over the Roman Empire. In fact, you have that nice passage, I think it's in Acts, where St. Paul is debating Epicureans and also Stoics. So the first five centuries of Christianity's existence, you find all kinds of diatribes against Epicureans, because on every point, they just lined up on the opposite side of Christianity. And you couldn't imagine a more antagonistic system. And so we have, you know, and I look at this in my book at some length, look at the ways they line up. You know, Epicureanism, materialism denies that there is an immaterial soul, and it denies heaven and hell, and it denies that the gods create anything, and it denies that there's any intelligent design in nature, and it reduces good to mere pleasure. Well, Christianity is lining up on the other side, saying, no, there is a creator. This creator is in full control of nature. Human beings are made in the image of God. They have an immortal soul and an eternal destiny. One, two, three, you know, every one of them, every point, they are not just different, but enemies, really, bitter enemies.
Right, and so in a sense, the culture wars have been around for thousands of years here as Christianity, and really biblical Judaism, and I think you lump together, though you're speaking of Christianity, all the great monotheistic religions in the same group as having, in a sense, the same heritage, moral heritage here. So Islam, as a theism, would also be able to make these same claims against or there would be the same kind of conflict against materialism.
Exactly. In fact, even non-Abrahamic religion, which would take as its beginning point that there was a designer of the universe, and our moral goal is to follow the design which the designer intended. For example, say something like Stoicism, that will line up on the side of the fence with Christianity and against Epicureanism.
Yeah, and an Aristotelian view of human beings and the telos, etc. And then, of course, Thomas Aquinas picks this up and makes a more robust kind of theistic connection there. But this is part of our Western heritage that really represents one side of the conflict, the Christian or theistic side of the conflict over and against the materialistic side. Now, this has many ramifications, of course, in our daily life and in social issues. And you speak about issues about the family and about abortion, about homosexuality, etc. And I think this is tied, of course, to your title, Moral Darwinism, How We Became Hedonists. Do you want to spell that out for us?
It's good to choose the title because it's got the elements, both of which need to be spelled out.
Because moral Darwinism almost sounds like a contradiction in terms, an oxymoron, in a sense.
Well,
or you'd have to redefine the word moral.
There you go. That's exactly what you should say. Because if Darwin is right, that is, if Epicurus is right and then Darwin is right, then one side of the culture war is right. And I'll show you what I mean by that down the line. That is, the moral element of Darwinism is a direct inference from Darwinism itself. Moral Darwinism is just the moral view you get in a universe in which there is no creator God defining human nature, and hence no creator God defining human morality. But instead of that, moralities, various moralities, are the result of natural selection and evolution. They are like all the kinds of varieties you find in nature. There are as many different moralities, as it were, as there are, you know, different things, you know, finch beak sizes.
Right, right.
Either one nor the other is right.
Now, the way Epicurus, though, cashed it out, as I understand it, the way you characterized it, is that he tried to make morality scientific, and the only thing that can be scientific is something that can be measured physically, and since pain and pleasure is the only thing that can be measured physically, ultimately, the only way to scientifically characterize morality in a way that's consistent with materialism is just saying pleasure is good and you know, pain is bad, which is more descriptive really than prescriptive, but that's kind of what they're left with. And so whatever turns you on is okay, I guess.
Or you could put it in Darwinian terms and say whatever contributes to the survival of the fittest is what is moral for whatever species you're looking at.
You know, this is the point, though, Doctor, that never made sense to me. I mean, I've written on the problem of moral relativism, and one of my chapters in the book is called Monkey Morality, Can Evolution Explain Morality, or Ethics, rather. And I hear many evolutionists make the claim that you just made, but they never make any attempt to cash this out. They say that our moral motions, so to speak, are simply the result of evolution, and therefore, if that's the case, anything that the moral good in this term would be anything that allows me to get my genes in the next into the next generation, and moral bad would be anything that doesn't allow it. You know, but of course, that would be, it seems to me, a fairly straightforward evolutionary characterization of what the terms good and evil mean, but those don't fit. Neither good nor evil do they comport with our understanding of what those terms are as we normally use them in society. So it turns out that this evolutionary explanation doesn't seem to explain anything.
Well, it sort of describes in reverse why certain activities or habits or customs would have occurred.
Uh-huh.
In other words, gosh, I wonder why people sometimes kill their babies. Well, if you look at other species, you see this and this and this, this species as well as this species, when they don't think they can take care of the young,
right,
younger deformed, they boot them out of the nest or they dash them against the rocks or so on.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that action, given an evolutionary definition of morality, would have to be called good, and we routinely call those things bad. And that's what I mean. It doesn't seem to explain what it's meant to explain, why we call those things bad. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it oddly enough, you have to come up with a peculiar one in regard to Christianity, which doesn't seem to really capture what Christians mean.
Mm-hmm.
But as you're pointing to the larger point, that Darwinism itself completely undermines any account of morality in terms of something that cannot be done because it's intrinsically wrong,
right,
something that should be done because it's intrinsically right.
Because those are appeals to something immaterial.
Those are appeals to something immaterial, but even more interesting is they are species grounded, I guess you could
Speciesist.
Say. In other words, when we say do not kill, we don't mean don't go out and harvest wheat,
mm-hmm,
or don't go out and shoot a crow.
Or step on ants or something.
Or step on ants. You know, what you mean is do not kill another human being.
Without proper justification.
Without proper justification. And what you see with evolution is when you undermine the stability of the species, then morality can no longer be rooted in the species distinction.
Yeah.
That
mm-hmm
a human being is something definite, and that goes back to something that occurred all the way back in Epicurus, that the denial that human beings have an immortal, eternal soul.
Right, and this is why Peter Singer, then, a person who comports with this ideology, is the, no surprises, the founding philosophical father of the animal rights movement.
Exactly.
Because it all fits together. I'm anticipating an objection here. We just have about 4 more minutes here, so I want to at least deal with this because some people may be thinking about this. How do you escape what really amounts to the naturalistic fallacy here? Are you critiquing Darwinism by looking at its roots and its kind of consequences here, or are you just simply showing us the philosophical heart and the price we have to pay if naturalism is true? I mean, all of these things that you're pointing to as consequences of materialism and naturalism might actually be so if materialism is true. It doesn't seem like your book argues against materialism so much per se, except for to show you that this is the philosophical groundings of Darwinism. I mean, somebody might say, okay, well, you're right, there is no good and evil, and there is no morality, and ultimately we're all animals, and there's no ultimate distinction, so there. I mean, how would you respond there? Do you see what I mean, the suggestion of
the
naturalistic fallacy?
You have it exactly. In other words, the book was designed to make clear why it is that you have two completely irreconcilable views in culture.
Mm-hmm.
And to push Darwinists to be clear about the real implications of their theory.
Mm-hmm.
To stop hiding in vague generalities mm-hmm. about the moral implications
right.
and just say it. This is what it means. And furthermore, to wake up Christians and realize what is at stake in the intelligent design debate
right.
when they really understand that their views of human nature and human morality cannot be compromised or mixed with a view of the world designed to destroy it.
Dr. Weicker, we're all out of time. It's an excellent interview. I had a great conversation with you. Thank you for the time we spent together.
Okay, wonderful to be with you.
Thank you. The book is Moral Darwinism, InterVarsity Press. How We Became Hedonists. I wish we had more time, but that's all the time for this hour. Next hour coming up, 1-800-227-5278. Greg Kokel and Stan DeReason. Stay with us.
And now for something completely different.
And I guess that completely different thing would be a massage from the Swedish Prime Minister, right? Greg Kokel here. It's for the Monty Python fans out there. And our second hour at Stand to Reason. 1-800-227-5278. Those lines are actually full right now, but you can dial in when I move through the callers. In the 714 area code, those lines wide open. 754-4150. And I'm here to give you a piece of my mind today. This is the show that makes your brain grow and turns your mind on. Mental floss to prevent mind decay here. Just a quick piece here. I haven't even read this whole thing. And I just read the first paragraph, and I'm stunned. Though I don't know why I should be, given the source. So before I get to your calls, let me just read this to you. California to enact bill. This is the headline. WashingtonPost.com is the source here. California to enact bill promoting stem cell research. Legislation challenges Bush administration on use of cloned human embryos. First paragraph. California Governor Gray Davis, in a direct challenge to the Bush administration, plans to sign into law today, that would be the 22nd, a bill that would promote research on embryonic stem cells, aiming to make the state a safe haven for the controversial cutting-edge biomedical science. The measure intended to draw a contrast with federal efforts to constrain the research explicitly supports work on human stem cells, including those extracted from cloned embryos. Incidentally, just for your information, ladies and gentlemen, our objection is not to stem cell research or even human stem cell research, but to research with human stem cells that are extracted from any embryo, cloned or not. Because to extract the human stem cell from the human embryo requires you to destroy the human embryo. And for people who say that you don't need a human being in order to get human stem cells, my question is, where do you think the embryonic stem cells are coming from if not from a human being, insofar as these are human embryonic stem cells? They are coming from a human embryo, and a human embryo ain't mom, it ain't dad, it's its own self. It is a human being. So just normal science, straight ahead. I don't care how you cut it rhetorically, you're still cutting up a human being and using its parts for research, destroying the human being, albeit a very small, non-complex, biologically speaking, human being. You are destroying it and using its parts for research. This is a stunner to me. And I don't know how it can happen. How can the federal government, this maybe just is displays my own ignorance about civics, but how can the federal government, by executive policy, outlaw something and the state government, you know, thumb its nose at the president and the federal government and say, well, we're going to do it anyway. I don't know how we're going to pass a bill. I'm going to sign a bill. The governor feels strongly about putting California ahead of the pack in promoting and encouraging stem cell research, spokesman Stephen Maviglio said yesterday. We'd like to encourage Washington to stop playing politics and support this research. Now, of course, Davis is a Democrat. It says here is also considering using state money and universities for stem cell research. So we're going to be one statewide stem cell research lab here. I hate it when people say we'd like to encourage Washington to stop playing politics and support this research, because either itself, this statement itself, is a statement of politics or it's a statement of ignorance. I say that because the Bush administration, through a number of its careful thinkers, including one Robert George from Princeton University, has carefully articulated the moral case. Now, they could be wrong, but a careful articulation of the moral case is not politics. So whoever made this comment, this would be Stephen Maviglio of the governor's office, we want to encourage Washington to stop playing politics, either is ignorant of this moral argument that was carefully developed and published and all over the internet, or he is fully apprised of it and still ignores the moral argument and claims this is playing politics. And if that's the case, then he himself is playing politics. It's just rhetoric. It's just wind. And I suspect the man is familiar with the moral argument. They don't care about the moral argument, and so instead they play politics here. Just another line on this. And we're not going to get into the whole thing against embryonic stem cell research. We've discussed it at length. I've written on it. There are lots on our website about it. But there is a piece in the news that relates to this here. I'm digging for it now. Can't find it. But apparently, where is that piece? Christopher Reeves. You remember him, Superman? Oh, here it is. Christopher Reeves is blaming the church and President Bush for his continued immobility. Of course, he's a quadriplegic and terrible accident in 1995, horse accident. But apparently he's starting to get a little bit of feeling back in his limbs, and he's slowly making progress, a progress which he thinks would be advanced considerably if the Bush administration would quit listening to the Roman Catholic Church. And since he's listening to the Roman Catholic Church and the Roman Catholic Church is dictating the policies of the president, then there is a violation apparently of separation of church and state, and it has a nefarious impact because lots of people like him would be better now if there wasn't this intrusion. But of course, the problem here, even with this approach, is that, well, there's a couple of problems. One of them is he ignores the moral argument. Because the Bush administration hasn't said, gee, what are we going to do about this? Hey, Vatican, what do you think? All right, I'll do what you say. It certainly may be the case that Roman Catholic thinkers were involved in the process of working through the issues, but it is the argument that matters, not from whose mouth it comes, Roman Catholic or otherwise. And so Christopher Reeve is responsible to answer the argument that was powerfully articulated by, as I mentioned earlier, Robert George of Princeton. I wish I knew the name of that article right now. I don't have it with me, but you can probably do a Google search and find it. I did. Just put Robert George and plus cloning, and you'll probably find it. It's a wonderful piece. And he does not get embroiled in the personhood discussion, by the way, which is important. Because our case in favor of human beings, whether through cloning or regarding abortion or infanticide or doctor-assisted suicide and any of that, has nothing to do with their personhood. Because value does not accrue to human beings as persons, but as humans. It is not human persons that are made in the image of God. It is human beings that are made in the image of God. And our transcendent value is tied to that image. Therefore, all human beings have the image of God and are therefore valuable, regardless of the stage of development the human being happens to be in. An embryo is not a thing. It is a stage of development of a thing. A fetus is not a thing. It is a stage of development of a thing. A toddler and an adolescent and a mature member of the species is not. These aren't things. These are just stages of development of a thing. And what is the thing that these are stages of development of? The thing is a human. Pretty simple. And if value is intrinsic to humans, that is, it accrues to humans in virtue of their humanity, you can call it speciesist if you want. Doesn't change it. If humans have intrinsic value and not just instrumental value, a value that can come and go when the circumstances change, then you cannot disqualify the value even of the smallest of human beings just because they don't look the way you think they ought to look. It's as simple as that. All right, to the callers now, and in Waynesville, North Carolina. Good to hear from the East Coast. William, welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, and I appreciate you calling.
Okay. I'll be. I love your show, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
I have a couple of quick questions.
Sure.
It's concerning God's foreknowledge and omniscience.
Right.
Okay, and there's a couple of passages that I came across in my own Bible study.
Mm-hmm.
From Genesis 6:6-7.
Right. Well-known passage.
Okay.
God expresses God's regret.
Okay.
Okay.
And then Exodus 32:14.
Right.
And then 1 Samuel 15:11, also about he expresses regret.
Yes, uh-huh.
And I looked up the Hebrew word, and it comes from the Naksham. I think I'm pronouncing it right.
Mm-hmm. Naksham. Well, your guess is as good as mine, since the only Hebrew I know runs a restaurant.
Okay, right. But anyway, what it corresponds to the Greek word for repentance also in the New Testament.
Sure, yeah.
And then I came across another scripture in Numbers where it says that God is not a man that he should lie, nor is he a son of man that he should naksham, repent, or regret.
That would be 23:19, I think.
Okay.
Or thereabouts, yeah. This is a problem that's been raised quite a bit lately, or an observation. Your observation is not a new one. In fact, there is a whole movement in Christianity right now, in evangelicalism, that uses verses like this as a focal point for discussion about the nature of God. And the doctrine, or the point of view that they espouse now, is called the openness doctrine, or the openness view of God. And Clark Pinnock is an example of this. Greg Boyd is another example of popular promoters of this idea. And their view simply is that the words mean exactly what they look like they mean, that God actually repented, he changed his mind, that he had one intention, and that intention was altered when he learned new things about the circumstances, that he actually showed regret and something... about the nature of regret when taken at face value seems to imply a lack of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That is, God intended one thing based on one set of understanding and then got new information, and based on this new information would have done otherwise had he known. And that's what the notion of regret is, okay?
Right.
And now, just to let you know, William, that you're not alone in your questions about this, and there is an attempt to answer this with a school of theology that is getting more and more prominent called open theism, okay? Now, the problem with open theism is it basically has to acknowledge that there are certain things that God cannot know. And this is their view, and they say that God cannot know the contingent free will actions of human beings. God could guess.
So against what the Bible teaches?
Well, yes. This is the debate, though, of course, because they would say, in defense for their view, here are the verses, just like you've offered, William, that make it clear that God didn't know the free will actions of men in these circumstances because God regrets. And then you see other verses like the Numbers 23 passage where it says, well, God doesn't change his mind. And that seems like a contradiction. And I'm not sure what the openness guys would do with that passage, that particular passage. But I know that they're coming down on the side of this new doctrine that says, well, God knows everything there is to know, so he's omniscient. But they redefine omniscience in saying that God is not capable of knowing a fact that isn't real yet, that is, the future actions or choices of free will creatures, and therefore his omniscience isn't compromised on their view. But certainly his knowledge is limited after a fashion from my perspective, because he doesn't know the free will acts of people. And this is this point of view. Open theism has come under heavy-duty attack by traditionalists across the board, evangelicals. And in fact, I suspect within the next year, most of these people will be bounced out of the Evangelical Theological Society because their view does not comport with evangelical theology, to
What's
put
your
it simply.
Sir?
My view is that those guys are wrong. And I'll give you an example why. And I'm taking the long way around here a little bit because I want to give you a kind of a full-fledged response, okay, since you called all the way from North Carolina.
Thank you.
I think there are virtually insurmountable problems with this view, and many things could be said against it. It seems that the Bible speaks very clearly in many places about God's omniscience as entailing knowledge of human beings making free will choices. God knows the free will choices, and in fact, this seems to be one of the ways that he proves himself as the true God to Israel. He says, I will tell you the former from the latter and the beginning. You know, I can tell you what the future is going to be and what's going to take place, and because I know all of those things. And it seems to follow from God's control of future events that God know those kinds of things, and that there aren't all these wild cards out there and undermining his sovereignty. Now, the openness guys are going to say, well, our God is actually more sovereign than your God because even though our God doesn't know the free will actions, he can still be in control of everything even so. And so that kind of implies a greater capability from their perspective. You know, I just don't think that's persuasive ultimately because the text, I think, teaches differently. And here's a problem that I think is one that they can't get around. Jesus predicted, for example, that Peter was going to deny him three times.
Right.
Now, what was the nature of that prediction? On an open theist view, God couldn't know really that Peter was in fact going to do that, not as a matter of fact, because that was an act of Peter's free will, and God could only know in a sense probabilistically that that would take place. Like Jesus is reading the circumstances, and he knows Peter so well. And he also knows, you know, the people who will be milling about there around the fire the night of the betrayal, that this woman would ask this question and make that comment, and Peter would have probably responded this way, okay? And so that's the way they'd explain it. But that's the problem, of course. He would probably have responded, but not would have responded. And that means when Jesus says it will take place, that his statement is fallibilistic. That is, he said it will take place, but he could have been wrong. You follow me there?
I think so.
He's not. He doesn't know what these people are going to do. Certainly, Peter is going to do. He doesn't know that. He can't.
Well,
in view of open theism,
can I interject something?
Sure.
If in John chapter 6, I think there's a couple of passages that talks about the nature of the person's will.
Yeah.
That Jesus would have had to know these and. There would not have been any doubt within his mind that what Peter would have done.
Well, see, I'm with you on that. Uh-huh. And so I see the problem there in the text, and I will suggest in a moment what I think a way to answer the issue that you brought up. But what I'm trying to show you here is that there is a popular answer now that's not going to work.
Okay.
The open theism answer isn't going to work because what it does, it seems to go against those texts that clearly state that God knew some action. And if you want to say that that isn't a clear statement of God's knowledge or Jesus' knowledge in the case of Peter, then they're saying they know, but they could be mistaken. And now you have Jesus offering a statement that could be mistaken. That's what I mean by fallibilistic.
Okay.
He could have been mistaken, and therefore his proclamation is not a certain one. The text is not infallible or it's not inerrant. It could have been mistaken. He could have been wrong. And then I think your whole question of Jesus' nature and person and the authority of the text itself comes into under attack, into question. So, William, I'm going to take a break right now. I'm going to put you on hold, and I'll come back to you, and then I will tell you what I think the best way to understand those regret passages are. I'm Greg Kokel. The show is Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
Hi, friends. This is Scott Klusendorf, and every year in the United States, there are over 1.4 million abortions performed. If you're ready to defend the unborn, then I want to enroll you in a class taught by Greg Kokel and me. Stand to Reason's interactive, Making Abortion Unthinkable, will prepare you to enter any pro-life arena, from one-on-one discussions to a public debate, with full confidence that your case is solid and your appeal is just. From the comfort of your own home or church, this easy-to-follow, well-reasoned plug-and-play course gives you everything you need to train yourself or a group in the art of pro-life persuasion. Through videotapes, workbooks, role-playing, quizzes, and games, Making Abortion Unthinkable will give you the tools you need to, one, restore meaning to the word abortion through the use of graphic visual aids, two, it will help you simplify the abortion issue by focusing on one strategic question, thirdly, it's going to give you the scientific evidence you need to make a sound, reasonable, and persuasive argument, and finally, you're going to be able to expose the four common flaws of pro-abortion rhetoric. If you're ready to take a stand against abortion, call Stand to Reason today at 800-2-and-the-word-reason. That's 800-2-and-the-word-reason, or visit us online at str.org.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel. Friends, you can help keep Stand to Reason broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift of any size helps us to continue training you and other Christians to be effective ambassadors for Christ in three vital areas. First, knowledge, helping you deliver a message that's accurately informed, made relevant to the culture of the 21st century. Second, wisdom, helping you develop a method that's skillful, tactical, and fair. And third, character, helping you cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about in the church and in the world, please consider supporting STR Radio today. We rely solely on the gifts of friends like you to stay on the air. So please call us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason, or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90807. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90807. And thank you for sending your gift today. Greg Kokel, back with you here on Stand to Reason. And just want to let you know about an event coming up in a couple of weeks. That'll be Thursday evening, October 3rd. I think that's a week from this coming Thursday. Is that right? I think that's right. Biola University has a great series that many of you have participated in, a series in which I lecture on a regular basis, have been doing so for years. And they always kick off that series with a free event. Now, of course, the idea is to trap you, right? You come for free, you get hooked, and then you pay for the rest. It's a great idea. But you don't have to pay for the rest if you don't go to the rest. You can still get the freebie. And so I recommend that you at least get the freebie because in this case, as usual, it's a great event. It's on Thursday evening, October 3rd, and it's going to be held at the First EV Free Church in Fullerton. So it's not at Biola. It's at First EV Free at 2801 North Brea Boulevard in Fullerton. And on one stage at one time for one event, here we go, J.P. Moreland, Hugh Hewitt, Craig Hazen, John Mark Reynolds, Scott Ray, Eric Thienes, David Horner. What a great lineup of people. And I don't know how any of them are going to get a word in edgewise, frankly, because each of them could command an evening by themselves. All on one stage, all at one time. The time is 7 o'clock Thursday evening, October 3rd. We're going to be there. I'll be there not as a player but as a listener, and I hope to see you there as well. Once again, October 3rd, Thursday evening, 7 o'clock, First EV Free Church in Fullerton, 2801 North Brea Boulevard. There in Fullerton, and this is Biola University's Christian Apologetics Program kickoff event entitled The Certainty of Christianity in an Age of Unbelief. Hope to see you there. All right, back to William. William, are you still with me there?
I'm still here.
Okay, so we're talking about how does God repent? What do we make of those places where it says that God was sorry, that he repented, that he changed his mind, especially when we have some other verses that says he doesn't change his mind, and one of the ways that Christians have attempted to answer this is through open theism, which I don't think is going to work, as I mentioned the reasons why, a couple of them. Well, then what do we make of these things? Mm-hmm. And let me do it this way. I don't think it's good that you went back and did some word studies, okay? In this particular case, it won't help.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why, because let me give you an illustration. There are places in the Scripture where it talks about the arm of the Lord, mm-hmm. All right? Now, do you think God has arms?
No, of course not.
No, of course not. I don't think either. But you wouldn't know that by looking up the meaning of the word arm, because you might find the word arm there is the same word where it says David's arms were tired or something.
Right.
Because in this case, he's using something about a human being, his arm, and in a metaphoric sense. He is not using the word in a different sense of its meaning, but in an analogous sense. So something about God is analogous to an arm. And when we think about that, we think, well, in those days, the arms were kind of where the strength was and the fighting and the sword and all of that kind of stuff. And so, you know, if I said, I am, my arm is, if I said, William, my arm is with you right now, you'd know that I'm going to be on your side. I'm going to fight on your behalf, right?
Right. It's a metaphor.
It's a metaphor, right. It's a figure of speech. It's an analog. That is, some part of a human being is ascribed to God, though we know that God doesn't have an arm, but there is a sense in which this figure of speech is analogous to something true about God. And so I think this is true when we read about God repenting. Obviously, the word repent in that passage is going to mean the same in other places where we have a genuine change of mind and a lack of knowledge about something. Mm-hmm. But this doesn't seem to be possible with God, because just as we know God doesn't have a physical body, we seem to have good reason to believe that God knows everything in the future, and he's not caught by surprise by anything. He doesn't learn things in that sense.
Right.
And so then what could this mean? And we have the very straightforward statement in Numbers that God is not a man that he should repent. And there it doesn't seem like he's speaking analogically at all, but it seems like he's speaking unambiguously.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems most reasonable then to take these references to God changing his mind or repenting as analogs to something that humans do, but not the same thing as what humans do. So in what way is repenting of a human being analogous to what God is doing? Well, it can't be analogous in the sense that God is caught by surprise as we're caught by surprise, but there may be a kind of emotional texture to repentance. Like we think, oh, I'm really sorry I did that. We are saying two things. We're saying, if I had known, I would have done differently, and I'm feeling bad about this.
Right.
Now, I don't think the first is possible with God, but it certainly could be the sense that the second is possible with God. And so in the same way that the word arm is used analogically, in that something about arms is true about God and men, but not the physical part, in the same way, analogically, something is true with regards to repentance of God and men, but certainly not the sense of the being caught by surprise or changing the mind, but being sorry or expressing the anguish about the way things turned out. And so I think that's the best way to understand it, that God isn't caught by surprise, but he's certainly capable of a kind of anguish that we feel when we see things have gone wrong. Not the anguish that we're caught by surprise, but the anguish that things have gone wrong, and that's being expressed in those illustrations.
But wouldn't that be showing, that type of emotion would be showing imperfection, wouldn't it not?
Well, only if you coupled the emotion with the other part that humans normally experience, and that being that God was caught by surprise and didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And see, this is the part that I think it isn't part of the analogy. In fact, if that were the case, then there wouldn't be analogy at all. Repentance for God or feeling sorry would be the same thing as what we experience. We are caught by surprise based on lack of knowledge, and we have an emotional response to that. But I don't think God is caught by surprise, so it must be an analog. And if all it's expressing is God's anguish over sin, that wouldn't express an imperfection, but it would be an expression of a perfection, God's holiness.
So you're saying it's a metaphor then?
It's an analogy, right.
A
metaphor or analogy, you can use either word.
Okay.
It's analogical in the same way that the arm of the Lord was against him is analogical. There's an analog or a parallel.
Right.
But it's not a perfect, it's not the same thing as.
Okay.
It is like, but not the same as. And so a metaphor is something that's
that argument. I mean, I don't because I would like to be able to understand how you came to that.
Well, I actually kind of stepped it out for you there. What we do is we look at the possibilities.
Right.
We have one verse that says God doesn't repent, and we have another verse that says God does repent.
So that's
now how is it possible to reconcile those two things? We have one verse that says God knows all things and essentially doesn't get caught by surprise by anything.
Uh-huh.
And then we have another verse that seems to indicate, or at least in one way of taking it, that God did get caught by surprise.
Right.
And so how do we resolve this? How do we reconcile these contradictory statements? And I think the best way to reconcile it is to say that one is speaking in a straightforward, unambiguous way, mm-hmm. and the second one is speaking analogically. And that creates a harmony there.
Okay.
And in fact, you and I would, this is something we normally do in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, William, if we had a more protracted conversation. In fact, even when you get off the line here and you might be thinking back on what I said, and you say, wait a minute, you know, I'm not sure that all fit together quite right, because he said one thing and it seemed to contradict. Oh, wait a minute, maybe he didn't really mean this in that second case. Maybe he meant this other thing, mm-hmm. and that would fit with what he had in mind the first time. Oh, I see. And we do that naturally.
Right.
We give the benefit of the doubt to the speaker that they're not always speaking in contradictions, and we're trying to think, well, maybe he meant this in a little more refined or analogical or metaphorical sense.
Okay.
And I think that's a very reasonable way of resolving this.
Okay.
Much of the time we have to speak of God that way, analogically, because God and man are significantly different, even though there are similarities, and so the best... Even from God's perspective, he's using language of things that we're familiar with, and so he seizes upon them to point us in the right direction,
uh-huh.
that God is something like this,
okay.
you know, like in Psalm 91, a bird that extends her feathers, you know, and gathers her chicks underneath her. Well, that's obviously a metaphor.
Right.
But there is a literal truth that's captured there.
Okay.
All righty.
Thank you so much.
William, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for calling there from Waynesville, North Carolina. On the same topic, let's talk with Dave in Garden Grove. Dave, welcome to the show.
How are you doing?
Doing fine. How are you?
Fine.
Sound energetic today.
I wanted to respond about the matter of open theism.
Okay.
Among other things, I considered this question more than 15 years ago and wrote some notes on the matter. Now, I don't hold to what would be called these days as an open theism question, to open theism.
Right.
But I would say that there is probably a slight variation that does a better job of resolving the conflicts that you just mentioned.
Okay.
The first thing is to take note of what the words omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence mean,
mm-hmm.
as actually used in the scriptures. That is, what is their practical implication? I start off.
Well, of course, the words aren't used in Scripture as such. We use those words to describe the bulk of teaching of God's perfections in those areas of knowledge and power and what was the other one?
That's all understood.
Existence, right, okay.
That's all understood. So when we speak of omnipotence, we normally ascribe omnipotence as being the use of all power all at the same time. But since God doesn't use all of his power all at the same time, a slight variant would satisfy nicely, and that is the capacity to use all power all at the same time.
Yeah, I actually think that's more of a classical view. I've never heard the first definition that you've offered, all power all the time. It's just that God has at his disposal all power that is necessary to accomplish tasks,
right.
such that any task that depends upon power, he has adequate capability to accomplish that task.
And just to finish off that quick point, the illustration to say that he doesn't use all of his power all at the same time would be to say that if he were to, that he would have created and put into eternal existence everything. That is,
well, yeah, I don't know
time,
if it...
That is, there wouldn't have been any time knocked off the clock. There wouldn't have even been a clock.
Yeah, I don't know that follows, but that's okay. Well, what's
right.
Then? I think you're going to make an application here to omniscience.
Yes, I have to lead to it one more stage.
Sure.
And that is to say omnipresence. And that would be, we normally would say omnipresence is being everywhere all at the same time.
Well, yeah, that would be imprecise, but I'll accept it for now. Go ahead.
All right. But since he's not in the lake of fire or the hearts of unbelievers, we would say the capacity to be everywhere all at the
okay,
same time.
Okay, well, this is where the precision is necessary then, because that's actually a misconception. The notion of omnipresence isn't that God's God's essence pervades everything, because if God's essence pervaded everything in that sense, there wouldn't be room for anything else, and therefore nothing would exist but God, and we'd be with Eastern religion. The teaching of omnipresence is that God is personally present everywhere. That means he is consciously aware of every location. And in this case, he would be in the lake of fire. He is consciously aware of what happens there, and he is also in the hearts of believers in that he is consciously aware of everything that's going on.
You mean unbelievers?
Unbelievers, yeah. So at that, in that characterization that you offered, I don't think is actually accurate.
All right. Well, then maybe it would require more precision. But what I'm trying to say,
I know where you're going with this, because then you're saying, well, what about God limiting his knowledge in the same way that he limits his presence and limits his power? But you see, knowledge isn't the kind of thing that can be limited in the same way. Power is something that you exercise when the need arises, and so you don't need to exercise it all at one time. God's omniscience, though, is a state of being in which he knows and believes all true propositions. There is no partial amount. There's no laying part of that aside. Either he knows and believes in them all, or he doesn't. And that's a steady state, as it were, unlike power, which has to be exercised. And this is why I understand. It's a clever move, you know, to try to make sense out of this. I just don't think it works.
Well, I would respectfully disagree on one count, and that is that the at least one count, and that is the reason why I went in that direction is from noting what Matthew 24:36 would entail regarding our own Savior.
Yeah, but there you have a unique situation, though, because we are not talking about God simpliciter in a sense, just God in himself. We are talking about the God-man, Jesus, in which you have a human nature and a divine nature united together in one person. And there you do have some interesting problems that arise, admittedly. But we're not talking about the God-man right now. We're talking about the nature of God himself.
Well,
and you don't have that kind of, you don't have any place in Scripture where God as God is saying he doesn't know something.
You mean?
And it's even odd when Jesus says it, quite frankly.
Let me see if I can also come back to a human science here to say that I was studying at the same time, and that is control theory. And we often have this notion that if God is not, let's say, omniscient in the sense that we're normally accustomed to saying omniscient, mm-hmm. that somehow or another the universe is also going to go out of control. But I know from control theory that isn't necessarily the case at all. Instead, all one needs to do is to be able to stabilize and detect something.
Right, yeah, but I'm not arguing that way. I'm not saying that the universe is going to go out of control if God doesn't know anything. I'm just simply saying what results from that is that God doesn't know something. So now if he doesn't know it, how does he regain the knowledge of the thing that he doesn't know unless he knows that he doesn't know it, you know?
Oh, I didn't say that I had complete solutions on this matter. I'm merely trying to indicate the paradigm, mind you, God can speak better for himself than any of us could.
Right.
But the paradigm that God, in fact, could, and according to things like Jeremiah 19:5 and 32:5, may very well indeed put away attributes from himself and perfectly recover them, unlike something
yeah.
we cannot do.
I can appreciate that you don't have the solutions to it. Part of what I'm suggesting here, and I'll just end with this thought because I got to go to break. Part of what I'm suggesting here is that the solution seems to be directly contradictory of the notion of omniscience itself, and omniscience, the knowledge of certain facts in the divine essence. His omniscience is a necessary quality, and so therefore it's not even possible for God to literally forget something. When it says in Hebrews that God forgets our sins, it means he doesn't hold them against them, not that he doesn't have any propositional knowledge of them anymore. This is tied up with the divine essence. It is a necessary quality of God. It can't be set aside from the divine essence at all. And the only time we see a hint of that is with the God-man Jesus, where arguably you have this unusual situation of the incarnation which makes this possible. But that's because of the human side of Jesus. It is not a liability on the divine side. And in fact, no one, even with regards to the incarnation, has ever suggested that the divine essence had forgotten something or didn't know something, even when it comes to the incarnation. Thanks for the call, Dave. Good shot there. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. More to come.
Have you ever wished you could articulate your faith and beliefs more clearly? Do you feel confident when talking with friends and coworkers about sensitive subjects like abortion and homosexuality? Call today to request the latest issue of Solid Ground, our bi-monthly newsletter. This free publication is filled with practical information and useful tools to help you represent your faith, even when discussing the most timely and heated of subjects like evolution, cloning, and stem cell research. Now you can avoid feeling uneasy or embarrassed when you want to stand up as a Christian ambassador. Simply pick up the phone and call Stand to Reason today. Don't get caught by surprise. In each issue of Solid Ground, Greg Coca will teach you how to represent your faith as an ambassador of Christ in a concise and attractive manner. Contact us today at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit us on the web at www.str.org. Just request our newsletter called Solid Ground. We'll send it to you free when you call 1-800-2-REASON.
Did you know that the old car, truck, boat, or RV that is gathering dust in your garage can actually change the lives of Christians around the world? By donating your used vehicle to Stand to Reason, you can help develop training materials that will build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. Don't worry if it won't start. We'll tow it away at no charge and help you with all the paperwork. And when we leave, you'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car. Transform your old vehicle into practical training for Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Greg Kochel here on Stand to Reason, the marketplace of ideas. Actually, you have a shopping spree in that marketplace here every Sunday from 3 to 5. And if you are listening to our show at oneplace.com, here's my encouragement. Scroll down that page where you found the show, and you'll find a free offer, Solid Ground. There's a button there that says Order. Just go ahead and click that. And follow the prompts and sign up for Solid Ground. That's our bi-monthly newsletter, which also includes a month-to-month letter for me also that entails more training material that will help you to be more effective ambassador for Jesus Christ in the areas of knowledge, wisdom, that'll be tactical wisdom, and character, an attractive manner. And we'll send it out to you. And in fact, if you're not receiving it, boy, you need to get it because there are so many good things that come through that. People are telling me all the time, this is practical stuff. So sign up for that. Check out our website at str.org. You'll be there as you sign up. And there are hundreds of things you can download. There are courses you can take. There, you can listen to other shows. You can buy product. You can take there's lots of stuff. That's why we have 70,000 visitors a month on our website and tens of thousands of things downloaded every month. A lot of free stuff that really help. So I recommend it to you. Let's go back to our callers. By the way, the open lines at the 714 area code, that would be 754-4150, those of you who are in Southern California here. Let's go to Al in Westchester, California. Al, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Greg.
Hi there.
Hey, I was listening to your call, the author you had on the...
Benjamin Weicker, Howard? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Moral Darwinism, How We Became Hedonists.
Right. And I mean, a question arose because he threw in all the Abrahamic faiths.
What? Oh, I see. Okay.
And if you look at the state of the Abrahamic faith today, the ones that reject modernity, relativism, pluralism, and materialism aren't doing so well.
Mm-hmm. Aren't doing so well in what regard? The Abrahamic faiths being Islam, Judaism, and Christianity.
Right.
Okay.
And in fact, Islam was a bit ahead of the curve as opposed to Christianity, when in fact they were more pluralistic, modernistic, were more materialistic.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean that the faiths aren't doing so well, these that have rejected modernity. And I presume what you mean by rejecting modernity is rejecting a philosophical view of the world that is naturalistic and materialistic.
Right, the one your author was talking about.
Right.
And the ones that, when I say not doing so well, I think it's apparent. If you want to look for oppression, slavery, poverty, a whole bunch of self-destructive tendencies, That's what there's almost a one-to-one correspondence.
Oh, this is false. I mean, just historically. In fact, we just got
how so?
Well, we just left the century with the greatest of human carnage in history, the 20th century, and the greatest number of, if you're just counting heads here, the greatest number of killings. Between three people, the greatest murderers of the 20th century, Mao, Lenin, and Stalin. So here you have a materialistic philosophy of atheistic Darwinism under the rubric of communism that has resulted, I think one could follow the philosophy from this materialistic point of view. So
Marxism was not Darwinistic. In fact,
the way it was practiced, it certainly was. It was atheistic and evolutionary. Evolution was at the heart of what they were doing, and their denial of God was completely naturalistic. I mean, here's the point. The point is that there's a naturalistic foundation philosophically to those points of view, and they produced unimaginable human carnage. Certainly, if you don't hold to materialism, you still can do evil things. But it doesn't. It is more likely that, well, let me ask you, do you think it's more likely, I'm thinking generally speaking here, is it more likely that people will commit atrocities if they believe that there is an accounting in the next life, or if they don't believe that there's an accounting in the next life?
Obviously, if they believe it, but that's not the point, because societies where people believe that there is an accounting, and we have to look at it as right now, as things are right now, going back to 1918 and 1932 or 33, when you've got a whole bunch of examples right now of just the opposite. And in other words, if you broke it down, I think you would find something else there.
Well, I'm just saying,
including the fact that Marxism actually became a religious faith.
Yeah.
Irrational.
Well, that's not. It's
if
not.
You analyze it.
Yeah. Well, and there is a sense in which that's true, that it became a religious faith. But then, in that sense, every belief is a religious faith, and so you can say that all atrocities result from religion, but it wasn't a belief in God that resulted in this kind of thing, but it was a belief that there was no God that seemed to lead to these atrocities. And I'm just thinking, let me just offer this thought here, and I'll let you get back to me. Taken as a whole, which one is doing better in terms of its track record? That moral point of view, a religious point of view that believes that God holds us accountable for ethical behavior, or that view that doesn't? And the answer is, on balance, the one that's doing better is the one that believes that God holds us accountable, even though this week or this month or the last 5 years since the fall of communism, you might find more examples of religious harm than in a sense, secular evil.
Yeah, but when you go back and you what has happened when you're talking about Islam today, which is obviously what I'm talking about, it's what makes the difference is not whether or not they believe there's accountability; it's whether or not they're pluralistic. In other words, when Christianity wasn't pluralistic,
it still
it was
isn't.
Not a great
by the
place
way,
to live in,
it,
and
it still,
when, as soon as you had the Protestant Reformation, which took hold for whatever reasons, you you had pluralism. You got the Enlightenment, you got the United States, and you got democracy.
What do you mean by pluralism? Just quickly, because that is given to different definitions.
It's the kind of toleration that European countries figured out they had to have if they were going to continue existing.
Okay, well, it's a weak pluralism.
Or being the best example.
Right, that would be a weak pluralism, the idea that we should let people believe what they want to believe,
yeah,
generally
speaking. Yeah,
the
kind of pluralism that John Locke talked about.
Right, okay.
And if you don't have that, it doesn't matter what your ideology is or whether you believe there's an afterlife or not.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have extremely negative consequences as far as the quality of a society goes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see, you know, in other words, that the fact that the new fascism today, instead of either being atheistic or worshiping Teutonic folk myths, believes in one God, mm-hmm. and so forth. It isn't as important as the fact that they insist that they reject a pluralistic toleration,
right.
Materialism and these things.
Yeah, if you're talking about simply what is working better now in terms of civilization, well, I'm with you on that. I would also argue that biblical Christianity also teaches The kind of pluralism that you've just described, certainly not strong pluralism, which would hold that all views are equally true. It just simply acknowledges the liberty that people have to follow their own gods and to follow their own way of life. A toleration in that sense that hasn't always been practiced, even by Protestants.
It took 1,500 years to figure it out,
mm-hmm.
and it took another 300 years after that to kind of
well, it wasn't the church was not characterized by violent intolerance for 1,500 years. Certainly during the Reformation period we have that, but we don't have these religious pogroms going on for 1,500 years. I mean, that's just a mixed characterization.
The crusade against the
yeah, that's 1,000 years. Yes, but that's 1,000 years. You know, that's 1,000 years after the beginning of Christianity. That's why when you, in fact, the first 400 or 500 years, the Christians were fighting for their own life. So I'm just, this
right,
is an appeal to keep things historically in balance. Al, I got to run. Thanks for the call. It's good talking with you again. And let's go to Brett in Canyon Country. Brett, welcome to the show.
Greg, how are you?
Yeah, fine. You made it.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I really respect your opinion. Listen to you every Sunday when I can.
Mm-hmm.
And
thank you.
I have a dilemma. I'm a printer.
Yes.
And I have a friend who is a very high-ranking Mason.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, he just got promoted to the 33rd degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a little bit of research on Masonry.
Right.
When I first got saved. And
mm-hmm.
I have concluded that I really don't want to be a part of it myself.
Sure.
Nothing I would be involved in.
Mm-hmm.
This person claims to be a Christian, though.
Yeah. Like many cultists or whatever, you're right.
I'm also kind of confused because even a lot of people I respect have been Masons.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of our founding fathers have been reported to be Masons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's true.
Well, it's certainly possible to be a Mason and be somebody who lives a life that you can respect. That's different than saying that the doctrines held by the Masons about Christianity and God are sound doctrines. And I haven't studied this very much, but I have friends who have, and from what I can gather from them, there is good reason to doubt that Masonry taken as a whole is actually Christian. And I qualify it in that way because there are some people who could be involved in Masonry but don't believe it in its most robust form, and they're participating in lower levels where maybe some of this stuff is not coming out, and they don't see yet any contradiction between biblical Christianity and what they've been involved with. So I think somebody could be involved in ignorance at certain levels of Masonry and therefore not embrace the full theological system, which, as I understand it, and I can't give you particulars, but is contrary to biblical Christianity. There's a good booklet that Zondervan's Guide to the Cults and Other Religions, I think, has a booklet on that, on Masonry. And
I think I might have that.
Yeah, okay. So your question, though, is more practical, having to do with your friend, as I suspect.
Yeah, I agree with you on how you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, if a Jewish person wanted me to print business cards for his synagogue, I'd probably do it.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with a Mormon. I don't necessarily see a problem with it, and initially I told him that I would go ahead and print it.
Mm-hmm.
But then he came over with all these symbols, and this is where I'm kind of freaking out.
Right.
Because one of the symbols is an upside-down pentagram,
mm-hmm.
like you see in all the satanic rock bands.
Right.
And all the graffiti and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He says it's not a pentagram, but, sure looks like one.
Yeah, sure.
And you may not even be able to answer this for me, but I'm having doubts again as to what to do. Initially I was saying, I'm just printing it. I'm not promoting Masonry. I'm just printing business cards. But do you have any input for me?
Yeah, I do. This is one of those things where I think, given a certain type of information that you'd be printing, it would be clearly outside of the pale, all right? If you are doing Planned Parenthood stuff and you're promoting then, through your help with their organization, printing that material, directly promoting the enterprise of Planned Parenthood, mm-hmm. I think that you certainly have a case to say no.
Mm-hmm.
If and other times you might be you know, printing something for a friend whose lifestyle you don't agree with, but the things that you're printing are not really participating in the promotion of that lifestyle that you don't agree with, okay? Even business cards for a Jewish friend, I mean, that's it seems somewhat benign. Mm-hmm. However, when you start when you're starting to print these kinds of things with these things in it that are really troublesome to you, then I think it becomes more of a concern. Now, to me, this is a little bit gray, all right? It isn't as if I could tell you this is, man, I can tell you with full confidence you shouldn't be printing this, because if I tell you that about the thing with the symbols, what about if it didn't have the symbols but was really meant to accomplish the same goal? And then what about your Jewish friend with his business cards? And so this is the point where I think your either conscience or comfort should govern. And quite frankly, it seems to me that your conscience is already uncomfortable with this. And the minute you feel that your conscience is uncomfortable with this kind of thing, I think you need to take heed to your conscience and do what your conscience says. Maybe your conscience isn't troubled by making business cards for the gentleman at the synagogue. Fine. Although one could argue, well, that's kind of promoting his business, and his business is a religious view that you don't think is true, and so maybe that's kind of participating. And frankly, if you felt strongly about that, I'd say don't do that either. But this apparently doesn't seem to be troubling you. But this other thing with these symbols is troubling you, and I think you have the sense already that you're maybe beyond the pale in this, and this is the fact that you called me expressing your discomfort is evidence enough to me that probably in your case you shouldn't do this.
Okay.
I mean, if your conscience is already kind of challenged by this, then I would say don't be so quick then, maybe to step back. But you might have to do some explaining to your friend, and then you're going to have to bone up a little bit on your understanding of the theology to be able to do so well.
Yeah.
All right, Brett?
I appreciate that. It's a good answer.
So I'm principally going with your comfort level, and it just seems to me that your comfort level is dictating that you shouldn't do this.
Well, I'll do a lot of soul searching.
Okay, I'm glad you're asking yourself these questions, though, Brett.
All righty.
Okay, got to go. Thanks for the call. Are we going to 58 or to – okay, we are. So I can take Dave in Hollywood. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hey, thank you so much, Greg. Greg, a real quick question, and we only have a short amount of time.
We do, I'm sorry.
I'm going to hang up. And listen, Cluann, this divisive issue in the church today called tongues.
Yes.
Could you please share what you know on that? I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay, Dave, thank you
for
it. Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for the call. And, the hardship here is there's a lot of different views on tongues. I haven't noticed that it's been divisive as it used to be. My straight-ahead view is that I see no reason theologically to think that the gift of tongues has no further application today, and that instead it has died out along with other supernatural gifts because now the Bible is here. That is an argument of one group of people, characteristically dispensationalists or other types of cessationists who believe that the miraculous gifts have ceased. I don't buy their arguments. I'm just not convinced the way they handle 1 Corinthians 13 and otherwise. Now, having said that, now I don't think there's a theological reason to believe that they have died out. I do think that there's a lot of ambiguity about tongues, whether tongues is other languages, whether the miracle there in Acts chapter 2 of tongues is a miracle of speaking or a miracle of hearing. Remember, it said they heard them in their own language. That's a possibility. Or whether the practice of tongues in churches now is being done as God would have it, even if it were legitimate in itself. And I suspect that most churches who use tongues violate the biblical principles on tongues. So there you have a thumbnail sketch, and that'll have to do because we're out of time. Thanks for the call, Dave. And for the rest of you, I hope you spend this week in an intentional way thinking about being an effective ambassador for Christ with an accurately informed mind. Knowledge, an artful method, wisdom, and an attractive manner, character. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week, friends. Bye-bye.